Due to the lockdown restrictions, we recorded this episode remotely using a podcast recording app. We apologise for the sound quality on this episode and hope it doesn't take away from your enjoyment. Thank you. Welcome to the podcast. In today's episode, we are talking to Amina Hassan, who is a systemic psychotherapist and has worked in the NHS for over 25 years. She recently set up her own private practice. Amina is also my sister. We start by asking her about her background in psychotherapy.
I've worked in the NHS for over 25 years and I've always worked in adult mental health. And I've worked with individuals, couples and families. I've worked in primary care, working with GPs and other members of the primary care team. So like health visitors, practice nurses. I've also worked in secondary care in a hospital setting in a complex care team, providing couple and family therapy, and also working one day a week in a complex PTSD service. And I left the NHS recently and I've set up my own private practice.
We were just wondering if you could, you know, take us back a little bit and talk to us about, you know, your career journey into psychotherapy and also telling us about what you enjoy most about your work as a psychotherapist.
I grew up in Manchester and I moved to London in my 20s. And one of my first jobs was I worked for the Refugee Council, which in those days was called the British Refugee Council. So I was working, although I wasn't a caseworker, I was working with refugee groups and communities. And often people would share really traumatic experiences, difficult stories of the life before they, you know, they became a refugee, and the experiences of being a refugee, both in their country of origin, but also here in the UK, and what they were struggling with. So I became interested in things like trauma, and I started doing courses on understanding trauma, PTSD and things like that. So that's how I became interested in the world of, you know, the world of therapy. And then I did various courses. I went to Goldsmiths and then I went to a Birkbeck, an Institute of Family Therapy. I trained to be a family therapist. I worked in the NHS. That was my journey.
What do you enjoy most about your work as a psychotherapist, Amina?
What I enjoy is working with people. Working with people, I enjoy, listening to people's stories and narratives. It feels to me that it's a real privilege that people share with me really painful and you know, difficult narratives and difficult stories. And I enjoy the work and I love helping people to change, sort of helping people to sort of reevaluate and reconsider and look at their beliefs and the ideas of how they live or how they have lived, and exploring their background, their childhoods, yeah. That kind of thing. That's what I enjoy. It's a real privilege.
Well, I was saying to Katrina recently about how you're the kind of person that people tend to just open up to in general life. Like, I know that, you know, wherever we go, and as your sister, I see it all the time, that people feel very comfortable talking to you. And it's people tend to share lots of their own experiences with you. And I think that's something about your character as well that obviously feeds into your work.
I agree with you. And, even as a young child, people would share really complicated things. I remember when I was 11 years old and there was a girl in the upper six. She was about 17, going on to 18 in her final year. And she used to catch the bus with me. And one day she just opened up to me and said that she was taking drugs and she was very unhappy and she'd lost her mother and her father wasn't very accessible to her and she didn't know what to do. And I was 11 and I knew nothing about drugs. I'd never seen a drug. And, I remember sort of giving her advice and saying, is there somebody in your family that you can talk to? Is there somebody you can confide in? And I was only 11. And then there were teachers at school, at secondary school, who would really, confide in me and ask me really difficult questions about relationships. And I didn't know anything about relationships. you know, 14, 15, 16. So people do, yes, I agree. I think people often do open up to me.
Can I ask you, if someone feels like they need therapy, mm-hmm. how would they go about accessing it?
I think we've got free therapy in the NHS. So I think go to your GP, talk to your GP, and you can access therapy by your GP. Or you can go online and go to IAP, which is Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, and you can refer yourself. And you will, you know, the NHS is free, so you'll be able to access, really good therapists. I worked in the NHS, and you know, my colleagues are still there. Some of my colleagues are still there. So yeah, I think that's one route. Or you can go and decide to see someone privately. So you can go on. There are a number of websites that you can go on. I belong to the United Kingdom Council for Psychotherapy, so you can go on that website and find a therapist that way. But the NHS is wonderful, so that's always an option.
We have a question from Twitter, which was, how should people choose a therapist in practical terms? And also, do you think that people should seek a psychotherapist who is of a similar age, gender and ethnicity?
Well, I think that's a very personal thing. I think, you know, I think it's also about access. I think if you want to see a female therapist, or if you want to see a therapist from your from a certain ethnic group, or you want to see a black therapist, or you want to see a therapist who's a Christian or a Muslim, or, you know, it's personal preference. So I think that, you know, it's important for people, if they feel that they want to see a particular therapist, that they should have that choice, wherever possible. But it's not always possible, because sometimes in the NHS you're referred and you get you're assigned a therapist. But you know, it should be accommodated, I think. But it's also about, you know, sometimes you might think, oh, I need to be with a female therapist, but you might not gel with that therapist. And it could be just that therapist. So it's about sort of engaging with the therapist, you know, have a few sessions with the therapist. See if they're a right fit for you. And the only way you can assess that is by being in the room, you know, doing the work and being in the room with the therapist. Then you can see if they are right for you or not.
Amina, you had therapy yourself while undergoing your own training. What was your experience of choosing a therapist, and what were the things that you considered?
Well, when I had therapy, I was very lucky in because I was trained to be a therapist, so I knew people in the field, and it was through talking to people that, you know, people would put me in touch with and say, you know, this therapist might be a good fit for you, and sometimes they were, but sometimes they weren't. I remember my first therapist. I chose a black female therapist, and I thought, yes, she's going to understand me. Great. But when I went and had therapy with her in those first early sessions, I knew that she wasn't the right fit for me. So then I went and found another therapist.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's about going along and having an assessment and seeing whether this person is, you know, is right for you.
And you only know that, I suppose, through having some sessions and really...
Yes, exactly.
It becomes apparent, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
I was going to ask you next what you think can be done to improve, and this was from Twitter,
yeah.
What you think can be done to improve access to psychotherapy in the UK, and this, you know, breaking it down in terms of financial support, and also some of the cultural barriers to psychotherapy.
Yeah. Well, I think we need, we have access, you know, to therapy in the NHS, you know, so through the NHS. But of course, the NHS has been, woefully underfunded for many years. And consequently, in the NHS, there are, you know, long waiting lists. So I think more resources are needed. Many services and many teams have, you know, have been, you know, sort of rejigged and, you know, sort of no longer exist. So, you know, the resources, you know, we need to put more resources into the NHS.
Yeah.
Because people need access to good therapy that's free.
Yeah. Do you think in some communities that there are still some barriers to therapy?
Yeah, there are barriers in the heads of therapists because sometimes in one service where I worked, the therapist who did the initial assessment would sometimes signposts people to, they wouldn't take them on for therapy. They would signpost them to local voluntary organisations and things like that, or, you know, sort of charitable organisations rather than accept them for therapy. So sometimes there are barriers in the heads of, there is prejudice and there is, you know, there is racism out there. I think sometimes there isn't a budget for interpreters. So people who can't speak English can't access therapy. I think there needs to be, you know, people need to be educated around what therapy is and how to access it.
Yeah. Do you think, people tend to not want to push for things that they might, you know, that are their right, you know, in certain communities that they just won't push for that, you know, where they've got a blocker put up for some, you know, whatever reason, they just accept that and then don't push for the therapy.
Very true. Very true. You know, that I've had experiences where people, you know, have been sort of, you know, haven't been accepted for therapy in the NHS and they've been referred to, you know, maybe a charity. And they just, you know, they just sort of accept it. And then there are people who are, who know their rights and who are articulate and who can, you know, can fight that.
Yeah, I just thought I would share a little bit of my own experience here. I've had therapy for the first time this year. And I was actually, I was surprised by how expensive it was for me to access in the UK. And I've used a website called betterhelp.com. Mm-hmm. And just touching on a couple of points, I was matched to a man, an American man, who I would never have probably kind of chosen. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's working out quite well. And just, you know, for people that can't access therapy, maybe you can just add to this in a minute. But are there any other, you know, any other things that they can do? Because a couple of things that he suggested to me, which have been really helpful, are to access my support network. And he's encouraged me to actually, you know, if I'm going through something difficult, speak to people that are already in my life, even though I found that difficult at first. And also just to slow things down, take things one day at a time, you know, because 2020 has been overwhelming for so many people, you know, lots of issues and changes going on. And I think sometimes when you try and consider all of them, it can just feel a bit too much. Mm-hmm. And so that's just been something really helpful to me, to just think, how can I have a good day today?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if you just want to kind of
That. Well, access people around you. Set up do you have a support network? Do you have friends? Do you have a family that you can talk to? Sort of focus, because we are living in really difficult times. Focus on, you know, doing small tasks each day and focus on today only. We can feel very overwhelmed because of these abnormal times that we're living in, you know. And sometimes our reaction, this anxiety that people are feeling is a normal reaction to very abnormal times, really. And hold on to feelings can change, you know, from moment to moment. And, you know, every feeling will pass and, you know, just sort of live, you know, focus on what you can do today. We don't have tomorrow. We, you know, no one knows what's going to happen.
That kind of leads quite nicely on to a couple of questions we had via Instagram, one of which was, what do you do to stay well and what strategies have you adopted so that you don't take on the stress of your patients?
I try and eat well. I try and go for a walk every day. I talk to my family and my friends. I avoid the news at the moment because there was a time in the early lockdown stages where I was just watching the news and I was obsessed with the death count.
Yeah.
And it just made me, it made me so anxious. So I try and manage my worries and sort of focus on what I can do day to day. My faith is a strong, I think keeps me well, my connection with God and, you know, through prayer. I like to fast. I'm into fasting at the moment. So I fast every Monday and Thursday. I find that very helpful. The other thing I want to come back to is that, all psychotherapists, all therapists have regular supervision, and you can, you know, discuss the people that you're seeing with your supervisor, and you can take issues around risk, issues that make you anxious. If you're feeling very stuck with someone and the work sort of there's an impasse and there are problems, you can take this to your supervisor, which is a space that allows you to talk about your struggles with the work as well, or your struggles with the person that you're seeing. You know, if their story has sort of brought up things, for example, if story has brought up, things from my past and things for me, I can take that to supervision.
Yeah, I think you've partially answered our next question from somebody on Instagram, actually, which is, I've had therapy for depression for many years. I'm interested to know how a therapist maintains their focus and that of their patient over a span of many years.
Yeah. You maintain the focus because you want to see this person. You know, you want to see a change. You want to help this person, sort of move on or sort of accept things that happened to them, or But sometimes you do get stuck you do get stuck, or you feel that the work isn't progressing. And then you would take that to supervision, really, and talk about it there.
Why might you not progress with somebody? What are the kind of reasons why you may feel that with somebody you're not making progress?
Sometimes it could be that the person might have been depressed for many years and feels that they can't, that this is who they are. That they can't change. Sometimes the person might feel that sometimes maybe the issue or the depression or the anxiety maybe allows them to be a certain way. I remember there was a woman I saw at Chase Farm Hospital who was very had been depressed for many years, had been to so many different therapists, psychiatry, and she was very attached to her depression, and she didn't want to let go of it, and she was in a really powerful position in her family because everyone sort of was very fearful around her, and
it suited her to be in
that place. So it sometimes that can happen.
So one of the things, we've spoken about this, about I've thought for many years that I should seek some therapy, and I haven't sought therapy, but I think it, and that's probably partly because I've not felt ready. Do you find that some people come into therapy that maybe aren't like me, may not have been ready for it at that time in their lives, and that it's not in that space yet?
Yes, very much so. Sometimes people are referred because the GP is exasperated with them because they keep turning up for, they want reassurance, or they keep making appointments about, you know, about, oh, I've got this condition, and you know, I need lots of tests and things like that. And so yes, so sometimes people are not ready, and you know, so sometimes it's the GP that wants them to have therapy.
Yeah, and they're just not quite there.
They're just not there yet. Yeah. But you know, it's when you're ready, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter really.
So just to finish then, Amina, we're going to ask a few questions that we've asked some of our previous guests. One of which is, how did your parents influence you?
I think my father was my biggest influence. From a very early age, my father believed in me. He believed that I was capable and that I could do anything. And this gave me great confidence. So I believed in myself. He believed I was strong and powerful and, you know, and all of these things, and capable. So I believed in all those things. He had a very strong work ethic, which he instilled in all his children. We believe in hard work, and he was very stoical. So we are all very, very stoical. But he also valued kindness and fairness, and he believed that we should never look down on other people because we don't know what's going on for them and we don't know what their struggles are. He had a strong faith, which influenced my faith, because he traveled around the world to many different places. He taught me about the world, the many different places he travels to. He taught me about history. He visited so many interesting places around the world, and I knew about these places, and I knew, you know, lots of things because of him. He also taught me to be very skeptical of newspapers and the news, and not to. He loved the news. We used to watch it together. And he taught me, you know, that not to blindly accept things.
Yeah,
you know, to think, you know, because something's in the news or it's in the newspaper, it doesn't mean it's true. To sort of go beyond what's written or what's said. He didn't have an easy life, but I think his faith helped him and guided him. And he was a very special man, and I miss him.
He was a very special man.
And how my mother influenced me, I think I lost my mother early. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 14, and she was very, very ill. So she wasn't able to mother me from that age. And then she died. And her death affected my confidence. I sort of lost myself for a while. And losing her meant that I couldn't live in denial of mortality or death. I think the world became quite bleak. The world lost its shine. But also on the other side, that because the worst possible thing had happened, I felt that I could survive, anything.
You were close to your mum.
Yeah, yeah, but close to my dad as well. My mother taught me things like, she used to tell me really interesting stories, and she taught me how to cook and how to use a sewing machine, how to sew. How to knit. She taught me how to knit. So
I think you're at that point you make about when you've had that kind of loss, nothing can get worse than that.
Yeah.
And nothing can really can. And we've spoken about this lots of times, haven't we, Amina? You're able to kind of navigate the world with a kind of, how can I put it? It's nothing can top that. So you can cope with anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of mentality. See,
yeah.
Yeah. It teaches you resilience.
Yes. Yes. But you know, it's two sides of the same coin. So you feel broken, because of the loss and the sadness and you know, the grief, you know, grief never really goes away. And you don't sort of, it's not something that's very neat that, you know, you go through these stages of grief and then you get to the end of grief.
No, for sure.
It's, you know, it comes and goes. There are times when I miss her. And there are days when I really miss her and, you know, and I think of her a lot. So you have that side of you that feels very sad and very, you know, and, you know, very broken. But there's also this other side that's resilient and quite powerful because you think, well, I've survived that. I can survive anything.
And it comes at you in waves, doesn't it? It's like when I became a mother, for example.
Oh, that yes.
That was almost like a revisiting of that early grief when I had my first child. Like,
yes.
It was like, oh, it was all over again.
Yes.
And then it kind of, you know, you live with it and, you know, you go through different cycles.
You do. And those transition points in life, like when you become, you know, like when you graduate from university and your mum's not there, but your dad's there, when you sort of get married and your mum's not there, you know, when you have your first child and, you know, you start thinking about, you know, what was it like for her to be a mother? What was it like for her to, you know, to parent? And you think about those things. And also for me, because I'm older than you, when my daughter got to 14, that was a really difficult time. You know? And I think, you know, it was the age that I was when she was diagnosed with breast cancer and, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah, all those transition points are, you know, grief comes.
And for a long time, maybe you thought, you know, you have that feeling that you're heading in, you know, that direction as well.
Like you do, almost. Yes. Is it going to happen to me? And I was really anxious when my daughter got to, you know, her teens, and I thought, oh gosh, is history going to repeat itself? Am I going to be, you know, am I going to die? Very much so.
Yeah.
I think there was no, I didn't have any women around me.
No,
you know, I didn't have any sort of aunties or a grandmother or, you know, so yeah, it was much harder.
Yeah. We didn't have the same mother we didn't explain that at the beginning.
No.
We shared the same father.
No. But one thing that really, really made me so sad was that, you know, that your mother died at a similar age to, you know, and history did repeat itself.
Yeah.
You know, and that just, you know, it just made me so sad. It broke me.
Amina, can you tell us where you like to spend time in London?
I love Greenwich Park. I love sort of walking in the park, sitting in the park. Yeah.
Our boy dad had a bench that he loved. We came to London pretty much every year.
Every year.
A lot.
Yeah,
and
it was always around Christmas, winter.
Always around Christmas, and we always used to go and walk around Greenwich Park. And Arba liked, Dad liked sitting at a particular bench.
Yeah, in the flower garden.
Yeah.
And often when I walk around the park and I go to the flower garden, I always sit at that bench and I just sort of contemplate.
Yeah,
think about him and think about the world.
Yeah. Lots of love, Amina. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed our episode with Amina. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. We're on all socials, Instagram at Portrait of a Londoner, Twitter at Portrait Podcast, or you can email us portraitofalondoner@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening.